Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. We've had a lot of computer issues. I think my computer is in serious need of vitamins. And we're going to continue with our series with David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And right now, we are into, I believe, parts 18 and 19 of The People That History Forgot. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. It's great to be back.
Am I correct? We're on 18 and 19?
Yes, that's correct. And
okay.
These are the last two chapters of this book, The People That History Forgot, by Dr. Ernest Martin. And chapter 18 is titled The Jewish Holdout Against Idolatry. So let's dive into this right away.
Okay.
And these are Dr. Martin's words. The time prior to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD was a very prosperous one for Judea and consequently for all the lands surrounding this central region of Palestine. But after the destruction of Jewish society and the temple and the city, with no Jewish monies from around the world coming into the area, the whole of the region went into an economic depression. And this was only intensified at the end of the next rebellion of the Bar Kokhba period in 135 AD with the final defeat of the Jews. They didn't learn their lesson in 70 AD, so 65 years after, they tried to rebel again. The area of Judea, along with the other areas contiguous to it, were turned into a desert type of economy. Peoples left the areas by the droves, and most went north or into the west, across the ocean. And for all practical purposes, the nationalities of the Moabites, the Ammonites, and Edomites, the Edomites are the Idumeans, they ceased to be reckoned as distinct peoples any longer in the Middle East. Their areas were, as we have explained earlier, their areas were reverted into a type of desert environment, and peoples from the peripheral lands, the desert Arabs, etc., came into these unpopulated regions. And this is when the Idumeans and other nations around Palestine disappear from history and become part of a group of races who blended in with the people that history forgot. Now, that does not end the matter, however, especially with the Idumeans or Edomites. This is because the Jewish authorities kept up with the migrations of their brethren, the Edomites. In other words, they followed them and understood who they were. Edom, or Esau, of course, was a twin brother to Jacob, and their descendants were kin to the Jews. The Jews reckoned that many of the Edomites migrated west, even into North Africa and into Rome. To understand this matter from the Jewish point of view, a few historical indications have to be taken into account. It was reckoned that in early times, even before the time of David, descendants of the Edomites, or a portion of them, moved from their area south and east of Jerusalem into the northern coastal areas of Sidon and then to Tyre, where they made their northern capital. Early history shows that the original city of Tyre was formerly located on an island just off the coast until Alexander the Great created a causeway to it, to the city, turning the island into a peninsula. The city of Tyre was colonized by a king with the name Erythras, meaning King Red, who came from an area on the Red Sea. Indeed, even the Red Sea itself which included all of what we call the Indian Ocean today and the Persian Gulf, was named after this king Erythras. This King Red, or in Hebrew, Edom, was supposed to be the first to sail rafts on the waters of the Red Sea for the purpose of trading. This first reference to him show him in the Persian Gulf part of the Red Sea. Justin Martyr, however, in his garnering of early Tyrian historical events, and this is in Justin Martyr's Dialogues with Trypho in Book 18 and Section 3, he said that the original Tyrians came to Tyre from the Assyrian Sea, which many actually feel was the Dead Sea. This indeed was the original territory where Edom first resided, but Edom expanded and grew. Remember, Isaac put a blessing on Jacob, but he also had a blessing through Abraham that they would become a great nation also. So Edom expanded, and trading colonies were established on the Mediterranean coast, in the Red Sea at Aqaba, and on the Persian Gulf. And these people were the first Phoenicians. The word also, if Phoenicians, also means red. And in Roman times, the name became Punic, P-U-N-I-C, Punic. Now, one of the chief gods of the early Phoenicians, according to Sankathion, it's easy for me to say, who was the first historian to write about them, one of the chief gods was Usius, who is clearly identified with Esau, whose other name, again, was Edom or Red, even in the Phoenician language. These people were called Red after their first king, who was probably red-headed, not because they had red in their complexions. They established trading colonies all along the North African coast and in several areas of Spain. Strabo said, the Roman geographer Strabo, he said that the chief city of Spain was called Gades, meaning the holy. Today we call it Cadiz. And this city was first established, Strabo said, by the first king, Erythra, also meaning red, according to Strabo. And this is in Strabo's Geography, Book 3, Section 5, Paragraph 4. They also built the famous city of Carthage that gave rise to Hannibal, who gave the early Latins so much trouble in the Punic Wars. To the Jews, they reckoned that these Phoenicians, or Tyrians, were descendants of Esau, or Edom. The Jewish scholar Rashi, in his commentary on Genesis 25, verse 23, states that, quote, Tyre was colonized by Esau, end quote. And there is a prophetic statement by the prophet Amos, which seems to show a strong affinity between Tyre and Edom. And this is in Amos chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. And in the first century, when it was expected by most Jews and even Gentiles that the Bible was prophesying the end of the age at that time, the Jewish authorities saw in the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 34, that the last prophetic kingdom to rule the world was to be that of Edom. And since Daniel's last Iron Kingdom was not identified racially, it was common for the Jews at that time, to state that this last kingdom of mankind was the Edomite kingdom of prophecy. And since the world was then expected to be succeeded by the kingdom of God, the Jews looked at the political environment around them and found only the Roman Empire as being capable, as they saw it, of filling the demands of the prophecies. Thus it became common in the first century to equate Rome with the final empire of Edom. So how did Rome become Edom? Well, there's no doubt that the Jews recognized Rome as the prophetic Edom in the first century. Note the statements of Philo, the Alexandrian Jewish scholar and philosopher, in his discourse on the unchangeableness of God. He started a major section on what he called the earthly the earthly Edom, and this is in section 30. He continued his survey on this earthly Edom through to section 36, where he then began to talk about whole countries and nations. He mentioned Greece, succeeded by Macedon, then Persia, succeeded by Parthia, then Egypt, Ethiopia, and then Carthage. And he then stated that now the whole of the inhabited world has been conquered. And this is clearly a reference to the Roman Empire. He did not mention Rome by name, but he then stated that even that great world power will also be destroyed by God. Philo then abruptly returns to his discussion about the earthly Edom in section 37. Cryptically but clearly, Philo disguised the empire of Rome with that and identified it with that of Edom. The identification did not stop there. When the individual called the rabbi, who's also known as Judah HaNasi, compiled the Mishnah about 200 AD, it became common to refer to those in charge of the Roman government as Edomites. The identification was especially appropriate at the time when the Severi dynasty of emperors were in control of Rome, from 193 AD to 235 AD. The first of these emperors was Septimus Severus, and he had the significance of being the first Roman emperor who was not of Roman extraction. And note where he came from. He was actually a Phoenician from their former trading colony in North Africa. As a matter of fact, he was so completely Phoenician that he never learned Latin until being taught the language in school. Later, when his sister visited him in Rome, her Latin was so Phoenician that he was ashamed for her to speak in public. He was not, however, ashamed of his Phoenician ancestry. Far from it, he glorified in it. And after becoming emperor, to show his independence from the old Roman institutions and from being a thoroughly, and to bring a thoroughly Eastern flavor into his government, Septimus Severus went to Syria, and there he married the daughter of the high priest of Emesa. And this was the priest of the Babylonian sun god. Her name was Julia Domna. Why was this marriage concluded? Well, simply in order to make a Syro-Phoenician hierarchy to be ruling the empire. The historian Perone, in his book Caesars and Saints, page 51, writes that Septimus now chose to ally himself with Julia Domna is the clearest possible indication that his authority should depend on his own race. Rome had defeated Carthage, Rome had dominated Syria, and now Carthage would unite with Syria to dominate Rome. And this union was highly propitious to the spread of Babylonian religious beliefs on a large scale throughout the Roman Empire. Now the gates were wide open. In fact, Severus was told by his priestly advisors to marry Julia. He was informed that great things were awaiting him and his race by marrying her. According to the historian Williams in his Historian's History, Volume 6, page 338, Julia was a sagacious and domineering woman. She had two desires. One was the elevation of her two sons by Septimus Severus to the emperorship. And secondly, it was to glorify her own race. It was to be Phoenicians and Syrians who were now to rule the empire. And under the Severides, it came to that very thing. Perone in Caesars and Saints, page 77, says it this way. Severus and Julia now wished to demonstrate that it was from Africa and from Asia that the life and leadership of the Roman Empire had sprung. Phoenician Syria still spoke and wrote the Phoenician language, just as Severus' own Africa did. Syria, therefore, was to be the scene of a magnificent rulership, of the revival of an ancient race. And indeed, Syria and Syro-Phoenician races became the top peoples in the empire for the 40-odd years that the Severide emperors ruled. Severus even made Antioch the capital of the empire for over 5 years. And when he was asked about his estimation of Rome, retorted that it was just one more province like the rest. And this was at the height of the empire, by the way. However, many benefits came to the inhabitants of Italy as they conformed to his policies, and in most cases they were completely willing to go along with it. Severus was followed to the throne by his two sons, who reigned for a while together and then successively. The throne later came to two grandsons. In all, the Syro-Phoenicians dominated the Roman Empire from 193 AD to 235 AD. And during this period, Rome underwent a revolution in society. This begins the time of the open Easternization and the Eastern domination of the Roman Empire. The two sons of Septimus Severus carried on their father's policies. But for our present study, let us look at the reign of his grandson, Emperor Agabalus. He reigned from 218 to 222, just 4 years. Now, this young man was a full-fledged priest of the sun god in his native country of Syria. As the historian Gibbon describes him, he was, quote, consecrated to the honorable ministry of the high priest of the sun. And this holy vocation contributed to raise the Syrian youth to the Empire of Rome. And this is in Gibbon's Decline and Fall, chapter 6. Actually, he was a member of the priesthood in the temple of the sun god that brought him to the throne. Gibbon continued telling how this came about and how he was supposed to resemble the former emperor Caracalla. Gibbon says in Decline and Fall, chapter 6 again, quote, the soldiers who resorted in crowds to the temple of the sun beheld with veneration and delight the elegant dress and figure of a young pontiff. That's the term that Gibbon uses. They recognized, or they thought that they recognized, the features of Caracalla, the recently deposed emperor of Rome, whose memory they now adored. End quote. His artful mother noticed the awe of the soldiers as they beheld her son performing the rituals. And then she proclaimed him to be the natural son of the murdered Caracalla. With this knowledge, the Eastern Army proclaimed him emperor, and very soon he legally mounted the throne of the empire. Thus, for the first time, a Syrian pontiff assumed the emperorship. We can imagine that such an ascendancy, or we can imagine what such an ascendancy did to Roman civilization. He brought in many religious changes in worship throughout the empire. Let's again read Gibbon's account of Emperor Elagabalus's reforms. One would think that a modern-day pope were being enthroned. And this is also in Chapter 6 of Gibbon's Decline and Fall. Quote, "The sun was worshipped at Emesa in Syria, city in Syria, under the name of Agabalus, Elagabalus, under the form of a black conical stone, which, as it was universally believed, had fallen from heaven on that sacred place." Very similar to the Kaaba in Mecca, a black stone that was supposedly fell from heaven. "To this protecting deity, Emperor Elagabalus," not Elagabalus, Elagabalus, okay, "not without some reason, ascribed his elevation to the throne. The display of superstitious gratitude was the only serious business in his entire reign. The triumph of the god of Emesa over all religions of the earth was the great object of his zeal and vanity, and the application of Elagabalus, for he presumed as pontiff and favorite." I'm glad he only ruled 4 years, otherwise I'd have difficulty pronouncing his name. "For he presumed as pontiff and favorite to adopt that sacred name." That name of Elagabalus was dearer to him than all the titles of imperial greatness. In a solemn procession through the streets of Rome, the way was strewn with gold dust. The black stone was set in precious gems. It was placed on a chariot drawn by 6 milk-white horses, richly caparisoned. I imagine that's, you know, set out in draped, all sorts of wonderful decorations.
Yes.
The pious emperor held the reins and, supported by his ministers, moved slowly backwards that he might perpetually enjoy the felicity of the divine presence. In a magnificent temple he raised on the Palatine Mount in Rome, the sacrifices of the god Elagabalus were celebrated with every circumstance of cost and solemnity. Around the altar, a chorus of Syrian damsels performed their lascivious dances to the sound of barbarian music, while the gravest personages of the state and of the army, clothed in long Phoenician tunics, officiated in the meanest functions with affected zeal, end quote. In other words, the whole government was becoming literally an Eastern court. The people were dressed in long robe-like Syro-Phoenician garb. The emperor himself dressed like a Babylonian pontiff, with full regalia. Or as Gibbon puts it, again in Decline and Fall, Chapter 6, "He was drawn in his sacerdotal robes of silk and gold, after the loose flowing fashion of the Medes and Phoenicians. His head was covered with a lofty tiara. His enormous collars and bracelets were adorned with gems of inestimable value." Well, what a description. Here was an emperor who was a pontiff himself of the Roman religions, dressed almost precisely like the popes today. Tiara on his head, richly flowing robes and precious jewels carried about. You know, the pope wears a huge ring. And he's being carried about from place to place. And this is what Babylonianism brought to the Roman world. And this happening just under 2 centuries after Jesus and the apostles were on earth. And this emperor did not stop with elevating his own priesthood. He also promoted the Syrian priests to the official priesthood of Rome. What is interesting is he commanded everyone to address him as Sardanapalus or Ashurbanipal, the ancient Assyrian king who was responsible for bringing the Samaritans and others into Samaria and Syria over 800 years before.
Wow.
He further claimed that the Roman Empire was, under him, a revival of the Assyrio-Babylonian Empire. And this is mentioned by Williams in The Historian's History, Volume 6, page 378.
David, in the area today that's known as Syria, that's being destroyed by
civil war.
Yeah, and people that our government in the UK and France are paying to destroy. Aren't there, or wouldn't there be, a lot of antiquities there, a lot of ruins, things that have yet to be discovered?
Well, there are, but Syria's been pretty open to archaeologists. But because of bad feelings, people haven't felt safe to take college groups there.
Yeah, well, now.
But the government has actually been quite open. The government of Syria, as far as I know, mm-hmm. has been happy to let people, archaeologists primarily from Europe, come and, do digs.
Yeah.
That hasn't been a problem, not like Iraq.
Yeah.
Where things were kept down, and things are, you know, opening up in Iraq. I'd go over there in a heartbeat if it was safe,
yeah.
both to Iraq and Syria.
Yeah.
You've never been to that part of the world?
One time, long time ago.
In Syria, you mean? Have you been to Damascus or Lebanon?
Yes.
I would love to go to the mosque in Syria. It's one of the largest.
Mm-hmm.
in the world,
mm-hmm.
built as a mosque and not as a church, I believe.
Yeah.
Whereas Santa Sofia is larger, but it was originally a Christian church.
And another question I have is there any relation between Phoenician and Venetian?
Yes. Yeah, we covered that earlier. It's the same thing in Italian. It's derived. Venice and Venetia is developed or derived from Phoenicia and the Phoenicians. Actually, let me look this up real quick on dictionary.com. See what it says if there's a derivation for Venice. Ports of northern Italy. Yeah, it doesn't really give a derivation.
Yeah, see, they try to kind of disconnect
mm-hmm.
the biblical history from the rest of the world. And I think it's very connected to the rest of the world.
It does say its word origin and history is from Middle Latin,
uh-huh.
Venetia, from Veneti.
Yeah.
The Greek is Oenotoi,
uh-huh.
Oenotoi, a name of an ancient people of Illyrian origin.
Uh-huh.
Venetian blinds, that term has been attested since 1791.
Uh-huh.
That's what dictionary.com says. Might be different in some other derivational dictionary, like the big Oxford dictionary.
Yeah.
That would be interesting to look up, but Dr. Martin did link the two.
Oh, good.
Not just because they sounded similar, but I think he had a quote. So this was in material we previously covered. But this emperor, who I don't want to name again, he was surnamed the Assyrian because of his pretensions, according to William's Historian's History, page 398. And this was the recreation of Babylon in the West. And these incidents are historically important because they show that this priest emperor was thoroughly Eastern in his politics, in his religion, and everything else of a societal nature. This was Babylonianism on a grand scale, becoming the religion of Rome and the rest of the empire. The next reign was that of Elagabalus' cousin, Alexander Severus, who has a name that's very easy to pronounce. His nature was not as extreme in religion as his predecessor, even though he was likewise a pontiff of the sun god. Alexander sought to conciliate some of the peoples of the in the empire who were upset over Elagabalus' abruptness in endeavoring to change the character of the state religion. Alexander did away with the most odious forms of Elagabalus' religious fervor, but he nevertheless retained some of the essential elements of sun worship. It is said that he, endeavoring to appease all the religions in the empire, erected in his private chapel the images of Jupiter, Solon, Plato, Abraham, and even Christ. He was the first emperor who tried to syncretize all the religions in his realm. Jews and regular Christians, however, would not allow these things. In viewing the five reigns of the Phoenician and Syrian emperors, The Historian's History of the World by Williams says in Volume 6, page 404, quote, "The Syrian emperors, as far as political traditions are concerned, inasmuch as they were not Romans and had none of the Roman prejudices, often give proof of an openness of mind which would have been impossible to the great emperors earlier in the second century, all of whom were intensely conservative. They flung the doors of the empire wide open. It was in religion, above all, that these Syrian emperors inaugurated a liberality of mind and a tolerance unknown before. The Syrian women of Emesa," by, you know, talking earlier of Julia Domina, Julia Mesa,
yeah,
Julia Mamea, Julia Summiamis, these were the mothers or wives of the emperors. They were beautiful, intelligent, venturous, to the point of utopianism, and they are hampered by no Roman tradition or conventionality at all. They dared to do what no Roman woman had ever done. They entered the Senate, they took part in deliberations, and practically governed the empire, dreaming of Semiramis and Nitocris, end quote. So, you know, during the time of Augustine, you know, the women would connive and deal and wheel and deal with the men behind the scenes in their homes and, you know, in the bedrooms, but they were not allowed to speak in the Senate. Only rarely did they ever even appear, except on official occasions. So those, going back to Dr. Martin's text, those 40-odd years of rule when the Phoenician-Syrian emperors reigned over the Roman Empire, like the ancient kingdoms of Assyria and Babylon, that was the very time that the Jews came back into favor with the Roman authorities. The precise reason why the Jewish people were esteemed is not known, but it may well be that the emperors were shown by the rabbi that they were the last power of Daniel's image, which would finally usher in the kingdom of God on earth. That last power, according to the book of Isaiah, though unidentified by Daniel, is revealed to be the one in which Edom, the twin brother of Jacob, would have a world rule. He would govern all the nations, according to Isaiah chapter 34. Besides this, the rabbi, who we read about earlier, could also show from the records that the Phoenicians who bore the name Red were in fact descended from Edom, which also means red, whose other name was Esau. And it was also easy to show the emperors that the chief god of the early Phoenicians at Tyre was in fact Usuus, or the patriarch Esau. Combining these historical factors together could have convinced the Phoenician emperors that it was the former Romans who had persecuted the Jews and the Edomites, the Idumeans, at the time when Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed. And now it was time for their brother Edom to come to their rescue and protect them. Whatever the case, the Phoenician emperors, who were so keen to introduce Babylonianism into the empire, left the Jews alone. All they required is that they not proselytize, and the Jews agreed to that. The Samaritans were not so honored and did not recover power until the time of Baba Rabban in the 4th century AD. So when these things are properly understood, the statements by the rabbi, Rabbi Judah, about the Severite emperors can now make sense. He knew that the Phoenicians, even from historical records, could be shown to be Edomites. The Encyclopedia Judaica has a comment regarding the rabbi and his dealings with the Roman Empire. Quote, circumspection marked Judah Hanasi's relations with the Roman authorities. In contrast to the Samaritans, the Jews adopted a policy of non-intervention in the civil war which broke out after the murder of Clodius in 192 AD between Septimus Severus and his rival Pescennius Niger. Judah was also careful not to flaunt his position outside Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, as is illustrated in the following story. Quote, Rabbi said to Rabbi Ephes, write a letter in my name to our Lord the Emperor Antonius. He wrote, from Judah Hanasi to our Lord the Emperor Antonius. Judah took it and read it, tore it up, and wrote, to our Lord the Emperor from your servant Judah. Rabbi Ephes said, Rabbi, why do you lower your dignity? He answered him, am I better than my ancestor? Did he not declare, referring to Genesis 32:5, thus shall you say unto my lord Esau, thus says my servant Jacob. End quote. And indeed, those emperors of Phoenician extraction were historically reckoned to be from Edom. All Jews from then onward, and even the Samaritans in their literature, refer to Romans as Edomites. Both the Jewish authorities and those of the Samaritans considered the Roman civilization as being governed by the descendants of the twin brother of Jacob. They were actually Edomites. And what is interesting as well as instructive, it seems that the two twin brothers, that is their descendants, had now made up with one another. And truly, the Jewish people were indeed blessed within that 40 years when the Severite emperors ruled over the Roman Empire. It was no accident that the rabbi when he had the Mishnah compiled, assiduously avoided any mention of past hatred to the Romans. There is no tractate in the Mishnah devoted to the destruction of the temple some 130 years before, prior to the time the Mishnah was compiled, and no complete chapter detailing the events of the war of Bar Kokhba with the Romans some 35 years before. And for more information on this interesting period of time, look at Jacob Neusner's book, The Christian and Judaic Intervention in History, pages 3 to 15. So this was a time of reconciliation between Jacob and Esau. And these good times for the two peoples allowed the real development of the rabbinic Judaism in a sense of solidarity and purity, which has lasted until our modern times. After the Phoenician emperors came to an end in 235 AD, the next group of emperors that followed until the rise of Constantine, well, they were soldiers, and not one of them was Roman. In fact, not a single one was even from Italy. Most came from humble origins in the Balkans. And by the way, the Balkan region was a stronghold of Mithraic sun worship, which can be proved also to have come out of Babylon. One emperor in this period was a Moor, and at the celebration for Rome's 1,000th anniversary, it was Philip the Arab who was emperor. The Jews even felt that this rulership of Philip was allowed by God to give Ishmael a part in the rulership of the world. Ishmael was the brother of Isaac, who was born before Isaac was born to Rebekah. Remember, Ishmael was born to Hagar.
Yes.
Although more often they use it to designate the Arabs who later developed and nurtured Islam. I'll have more to say on Islam in the next chapter. Well, the truth is, Rome by this time had become a Semitic empire for all practical purposes. The Jewish historians and scholars saw these things happening in front of their eyes, and they called attention to them in various ways in their later writings. These emperors who followed the Severites were all keenly aware and interested in the new Eastern religions, which were now completely infiltrated into the empire. One of them was Aurelian. This is different than Marcus Aurelius, but Aurelian, who reigned from 270 to 275, he was from the Balkans. His father was a farmer, while his mother, like the Syro-Phoenician emperor's mothers, was a priestess of the sun. This is according to Williams, Historian's History, Volume 6, page 421. He grew up as an adherent of the sun god cult. And indeed, when Constantine came to power, and before his conversion to Christianity, he was also a worshiper of the sun god, just like most emperors in the previous 150 years. With all this Babylonian sun god ritual in evidence, we can well imagine how the Roman world was turning into a Babylonian and Assyrian type of society. And it was progressively getting more Eastern all the time. The complete transformation, however, came with Diocletian, the predecessor of Constantine. The Historian's History of the World, Volume 6, page 435 by Williams, says, quote, "Diocletian permanently introduced the Eastern forms of government. Until his time, the outward appearance of the emperor had only a passing air of Easternism. But with Diocletian, this character of government was established for all time to come. From Diocletian, the white bandeau or diadem, borrowed from the East, became the distinctive sign of the ruler. While formerly the purple raiments had been the sole sign, Diocletian and his next successor, Constantine, introduced the remaining Eastern regal ornaments. The Emperor Aurelian had indeed set the example here. And then in page 456, William says, the Asian pomp, which had been adopted by Diocletian, assumed an air of softness and effeminacy in the person of Constantine. Indeed, the whole court, by the time of Constantine, was now completely Babylonian. Constantine's rule was as an Eastern monarchy, now in the West. This point, though vitally important in understanding the history of late antiquity, is actually hardly emphasized by historians in our late 20th century. They don't care about such things. Scholars in the first part of this century were different. Dr. Shotwell of Columbia University, speaking of Diocletian and Constantine's day, he said, as Williams quotes in Historians History, Volume 7, pages 13 and 14, the tongue of Greece gave free access to the philosophy of the East, and its pantheon was filled with all the gods of the world. Rome's thought became the reflex of that of the Hellenized East. In other words, the thought of Syria and Egypt. If Rome conquered the ancient world, it was made captive in return. The Roman government and society were no longer Roman in anything but name. The administration of the empire had become a Persian absolutism inherited from Babylon, and its society was verging towards Eastern caste, an Eastern caste system. With Constantine, we find the real completion of the Babylonian and the diasporic Samaritan movements to Rome and to Italy and to the rest of the western parts of the empire. By now, not only the people, but the religion, philosophy, and even the government of old Babylon had been transferred to the West. And with an acceptance of the Constantinian form of Christianity, the type which introduced Babylonian idolatry and pagan teachings into the bosom of the Christian church, the power had now arisen which was to govern the future Western world, a force which is still influencing us today. And note this carefully. Professing Christianity today has more idolatrous images, pictures, icons, and other symbols and designs that violate the clear text of the Second Commandment more than any other pagan religion on earth today.
Yeah.
The use of images dominates our type of Christianity. The Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics shows that modern-day Christianity is far and away the greatest violator of the second of the Ten Commandments. According to Hastings' Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, Volume 7, page 111, no religion can rival Christianity in the multiplicity of its images. In some large churches, such as the French cathedrals of Paris, Chartres, Reims and Amiens, there are as many as 2,000, 3,000, or 4,000 statues. And in the cathedrals of Chartres, Bourges, and Le Mans, 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000 figures on stained glass. Although quite a number of these are figures of unimportant personages, nevertheless, we have here what has been called a whole Bible for the use of the unlettered, so they could teach the stories by picture form. Next to Christianity comes Buddhism, which has covered India, Ceylon, and the Malay archipelago with its bas reliefs and flooded Tibet, China, and Japan with its painted images. in this that has been imitated by other religions of the Far East, including Hinduism. It is superfluous to mention here the service rendered to art by the mythological compositions of the Greco-Roman sculpture. Of less importance from an aesthetic point of view, but nonetheless interesting, are the bas-reliefs and paintings from Egypt and the sculptures of Mesopotamia and Asia Minor. It may be said that the region where religious images are found forms a belt on the surface of the globe, which includes the northern hemisphere, from Japan to Mexico, while in the southern hemisphere, there are only some rudiments of art. End quote. So, is it not interesting that Christianity outperforms all of Buddhism and Hinduism in the use of religious images in their worship services today? Not only that, we also far outdistance ancient Egypt. And even more revealing is the fact that modern Christianity even outproduces ancient Mesopotamia in idolatry, where the biblical prophets said that idolatry began. And yes, our indulgence is greater even than that of Greece and of Rome. The truth is, the Eastern peoples who came from Babylon, Syria, Asia Minor, Samaria, Edom, and Phoenicia, etc., were very successful indeed in depositing and cultivating the use of images in their worship, right in the heart of Rome and the West. And what is even more interesting, despite the teaching of the Second Commandment, is the fact that Christians have accepted these Eastern Babylonian idolatrous practices, even to the bosom of the Christian Church, and that Christianity is now the chief propagator in the world of image-making and worship. We are an idolatrous society, and yet we claim to be Christian at the same time. This is precisely what Simon Magus intended to introduce to the West. He and his successors were very successful. This is what Eusebius and Epiphanius in the 4th century AD saw was occurring among the people, even in the highest echelons of government. These early Christian fathers abhorred that trend. They even tried to persuade the rulers not to make pictures or images of Jesus, even if the images were true depictions, which of course they were not. Making them and placing them in homes and churches was illegal, according to them. It was to them a violation of the Second Commandment. It also made no difference if people worshiped before the pictures or images or not. Indeed, even the possession of them was illegal, according to Eusebius and Epiphanius, from a religious point of view, and all previous fathers of the Christian community, back to the time of the apostles. Remember, in 1 John it says, "Flee from idolatry." So such pictures and images were not allowed even for simple decoration. But today, we witness these idolatrous images, idols, and pictures in profusion, even within most Christian circles. For the past 1,600 years, since the time of Constantine the Great, they have been perpetuated by our traditional Christianity. And remarkably, this has been done in spite of the express teaching of the Apostle Paul, "Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry," 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 14. The whole of Europe in the 6th century could be said to have become an idolatrous and image-making society, which called itself Christian. It is this very thing that caused a major reaction in the Middle East in the 7th century when a young man from the Quraysh tribe of Mecca in Arabia looked on all the idolatry around him, both among the pagan Arabs and the Christians, and decided to do something about it. In the next chapter, I wish to make some comments about Muhammad himself, which many people may not have realized, and also about the original source of our world religions. It may be a surprise to people, but the people that history forgot are involved in these historical events also. So thank you, Georgianne. And the next chapter is the last chapter.
Wow, this is very, very interesting material.
Yes, yeah, it is.
You know, I think the Venetians, actually migrated to London, what we call London today, the city of London. Yeah.
In ancient times, well, maybe the original Latins that lived there, although it wasn't always a major port city until till after the first century, I don't think. I don't know quite the history of it, but only later, I think during Byzantine times, did it gain prominence.
Wow.
So, well, how are we doing on time? Should we split this? Or?
Yes, I think we should.
Okay.
So this is chapter 18?
Correct, that we just finished, yeah.
Okay, and we will start on chapter 19 with David Seeloff. So move to chapter 19, everybody.